Today, I'll continue the series of talks on liberative dependent arising. And in one place where the Buddha talked about these steps, or very similar steps, he likened it to rainwater falling on this mountain. And then as the mountain, the water comes down, drops, they flow down and they join together. And joining together, they form little streamlets. The little streamlets form little streams. And the streams become rivulets, and the rivulets become rivers. And the rivers become large things, Mississippi rivers, and then they flow into the great ocean. And it's described in this way as a flow downhill. Though when we sit here and practice, it can feel like a mountain we're climbing. But I like this image of flowing downhill, because I think of the practice as a homecoming. We're coming home. We're coming home to ourselves. We're coming home to our own hearts. And it's not meant to be a fight against ourselves, but as a way of settling and coming to peace here and coming back to maybe to some ways almost what's innate within us. Some capacity for being integrated, being whole, being at ease, profound peace, to be able to be at peace in this world. And this momentum of the river flowing down the mountain kind of begins to get more serious, kind of flow at the junction that we're at now with the seventh and eighth steps of liberative dependent origination. And those two are samadhi and seeing things as they are. And there's something about seeing things as they are, as opposed to what we wish them to be, or hope them to be, or what we guess them to be, or assume they to be, but really to see things begins kind of opening the heart, opening the mind, to allow us to just kind of start flowing in harmony with how things are, to open up to how things are, to align ourselves with the nature of the world, so that that movement towards freedom becomes more of a heart's call than an idea. It's more like a flow, or kind of a intuitive perhaps, or inner kind of releasing ourselves to a calling, to a longing, to gravity, to the heart's gravity, and opening to and kind of responding to that, and giving into that, and allowing this to keep flowing. So it's kind of a big transition coming to this point. So there's samadhi and seeing things as they are. And I like the word samadhi better than the word concentration, because concentration implies for some people a contracting and narrowing and a kind of laser focus from the control tower in the head. And some people have that kind of idea, like it's got really concentrated like a laser. It's kind of like they're almost like using their eyes, sometimes literally, even with their eyes closed, or maybe with their mind's eye, really kind of like bore down at what's there. And as if it's a kind of very particular kind of mental activity that we engage in. But the word samadhi is not an activity, it's a state that we enter into. And it's a state of being that arises when we feel, in the ancient world, the Buddha talked about when we feel have faith, confidence, delight, joy, tranquility, and happiness. In the modern world, nowadays, one of the, maybe in addition to that, something that's recognized as being so important is a feeling of safety, feeling safe, so something can open up and release and relax, so that we can have a willingness to just be here, undefended, unguarded, without a need to apologize for ourselves, without the need to prove ourselves. We can just be here, that kind of safety. And so samadhi is a state of being, more than a mental activity. And as a state of being, it includes all of ourselves. And that's kind of what makes samadhi kind of is an integrated experience of our whole being. So you can't really leave yourself out, or ideally you wouldn't leave any part of yourself out. And it's possible to get into strong states of concentration that pushes things aside, ignores parts of ourselves. And sometimes it can be very satisfying, and strong altered states can be kind of fun sometimes. But the Buddha described the kind of concentrated mind that he was looking for in practice. It's a soft, malleable, workable, purified, unblemished, unified kind of state. You can't really do it by forcing some part of yourself aside. It's a different kind of concentration. It's not right concentration. And so to have this softness and settleness, this integration, not all of ourselves included, as part of this state of being we settle into. And I very closely associated with another state, which also has the with prefix, kan or kam, and that's compassion. And concentration is with a center, maybe, and compassion is with the suffering, to be with it with empathy. And it's a beautiful quality of the heart, of our being, the capacity to be soft, tender, caring, empathic with the suffering of our own suffering and the suffering of others. And there also, you can't really have compassion if you hold something at bay, like I'm not going to include that as part of me, hold that apart. And compassion is also a kind of integrated state of softness, openness, workability. I think of it as kind of an integrated state, where we have the kind of integration that allows us to be willing, maybe because we feel safe enough, to feel the suffering of the world and our own suffering, willing to let our heart break sometimes. But this kind of a soft tenderness of compassion, for me, comes very closely kind of together with the samadhi. Maybe you can't have one without the other, or maybe one kind of evokes the other. So this idea of being here. So there was a story from ancient China of apparently there was a monarch in the realm who maybe was troubled in some way and wanted to have a painting that depicted peace. And so created a contest to see who would come up with the most strongest kind of painting that evoked peace for the monarch. And many of the great artists of the realm submitted their paintings. And you can probably imagine, you know, some of the paintings and serene, natural landscapes that just, you know, serene, clear, flat, tranquil bodies of water, and I don't know, all kinds of things. And none of them did it for the monarch. So the contest was spread out across the land, and more and more people and all kinds of people submitted their paintings, and nothing worked for the monarch. And then finally, someone, minister or someone, said, well, we've pretty much tapped into every painter in the realm, but there is this one person deep, deep, far in the mountains, a poor farmer that seems to kind of, you know, on his or her free time, seems to, you know, do some painting. So they brought this person back to the capital and maybe locked the person up and said, you have to make a painting. Can you please make a painting and get the depicting piece? And so a person spent a long time, you know, making this painting, and large painting. And finally there was an unveiling in front of the monarch. And monarch went into this room and stood back, and the drape was pulled off the painting. There was this torrential waterfall coming over a cliff, like, you know, big, powerful, you know, hitting the bottom of, you know, the river and bouncing back up with foam and steam, and it was kind of violent. And the king, the monarch said, how could this be, you know, what's going on here? This is not peaceful. And so the painter said, come here, come closer. So they walked really close into the painting. See right there? And in fact, on the cliff side where the waterfall was pouring over, there was a couple of rocks and a ledge. And so that the rocks kind of, some of the water kind of parted a little bit. And if you look at the little place where it parted, a little gap, if you looked in, there was a ledge. And in there was a little bird's nest with a bird with its little baby birds. And the mother bird was there tending and caring very peacefully and feeding little babies. And the babies, you know, were probably could feel the calm and the peace of the mother. And so they were pretty calm and peaceful too, and just sitting there. So that painter won the contest. And so it was nice about, I don't know, you know, exactly why the monarch valued this one over all the other ones, but you can probably imagine some reasons. And one of them is that it's a piece that's not apart from the hustle and bustle of the world, the difficulties and challenges of the world, even the violence of the world. It's so much going on in our world that we live in. And that can seem like reasons not to allow ourselves to be at peace, not to allow ourselves to rest or to sleep or to, you know, we have to always be on our guard, always do something. But here was a spirit had found out how to be at peace, you know, represented peace in the middle of all that. And that maybe felt to the monarch as a real peace, a peace that was, you know, integrated or found, you know, in the world rather than apart from it. And then this idea of the nest, you know, a place to, the home, you know, it's a place you come and nest and be cozy and maybe be safe. And the idea of the mother or the parent bird, or, you know, they are caring for the little ones. There's that, you know, the care, the tenderness, maybe the compassion, together with the peace, the settledness, and just being rooted and settled there in that ledge. So samadhi, compassion, peaceful, being settled, being here in our nests, in the nest of your heart, the nest of your body, and to recognize, yes, there's all kinds of challenges and energy and waterfalls flowing by here and there, but it's possible to make oneself a nest, to make oneself, one's heart, a place to settle, or one's own being to settle and be here. So what I like for as an alternative translation to samadhi is not concentration, but composure. to be composed. And partly I like that because composure, in my mind, represents more of a whole state of being. So even something you do with your whole body, you compose your body. First thing some people do, if they're told to compose yourself, they probably take a deep breath and make themselves a little bit tall and exhale and kind of just settle in. That's the first gesture of being composed. Or compose your mind, compose your heart. So it's something more full than the associations I have with concentration. And so to find this composure in the middle of our experience, with whatever's happening, whatever the waterfall is of the moment, can we find our composure with the experience here? And what it partly means is a willingness to really be here with the experience that we're having now. And because it's very hard to develop the kind of useful samadhi if we spend a lot of time thinking. If we spend a lot of time thinking about the future or the past, or thinking about fantasy, or thinking about our challenges, our conflicts, our worries. If you spend a lot of time thinking about concentration, it's very hard to kind of, you know, get composed and settled. But it requires really being here, and being here in the nest of the present moment. And it's I like the idea of the nest being kind of like a bowl, because if you're not in the bottom of the bowl, if the marble is not the bottom of the bowl, it's spinning, it's rolling around. And you put a marble in a bowl, it rolls back and forth until the energy is gone and it rests at the bottom. Unless you come along and keep pushing the marble, then it keeps spinning. It can go on for a lifetime that way. Your marbles have probably been, you know, playing around for a long time. And partly samadhi is finally some of these loose marbles get a chance to come down and rest in the bottom of the bowl, and they can be still. And the present moment is that in the bottom of the nest, the bottom of the bowl. Because anywhere else, it's actually work to stay engaged and involved in it. It's actually energy or spinning the marble more. But the one place where this mind can really has a chance to really settle, be relaxed, and really be here is the present moment. So the emphasis on it is, come here and rest, come here and settle in. Come here and trust that you don't have to be anywhere else. Come here and understand that it's for your greatest good to learn how to settle and be in this moment and be here settled and fully here. So composed on the experience, composed here. So rather than concentrating on your breathing, perhaps you can compose yourself on your breath. Does that create a different approach, a different way of entering or being with the breath if you compose yourself on it? I know sometimes I've tried to concentrate on my breathing or concentrated on my steps walking, and I've ended up with a headache because of the mental strain of trying to kind of thinking I had to be in the control tower and be the doer of it. But when I compose myself, it's such a physical, embodied kind of thing that it kind of lets my poor little brain have a break, because something else is doing the work. Compose. So compose yourself on the breath. Settle on the breath. Settle on the feet. To borrow, you know, the word concentration, the related word I like is concentric. You know, with the center, I guess. But concentric circles are circles that have the same center. And so I think one approach I've had for approaching this settled, composed samadhi is the idea that's integrated, that's inclusive, is the idea that we start with settling ourselves on the widest concentric circle of who we are, of what our experience is. What's happening right here? Here I am, a person who's thinking about the future, who's worried, who's also thinking about this and that, and you're scattered and all that. And rather than fighting that, and rather than overriding it and trying to stay with the breath, one approach is to open up and relax as wide, as fully as you can, the widest concentric circle that can hold that. Okay, this is a full catastrophe. But make your nest bigger than the catastrophe. Make your mind, your awareness bigger. Compose yourself so you're kind of like bigger. Because always, you're always bigger than any of your problems. I guarantee it. Your problems are all, they might seem big, but you're always bigger. So the idea of settling, opening up and feeling your bigness, your largeness, and can hold it all, the full catastrophe. So we're not fighting it, maybe, or find some rest in it. One of the biggest labels I've had for when I did a lot of mental noting of my experience that kind of seemed to cover it all for me, that when nothing else seemed to be the proper word to recognize my experience, it was the word chaos. it's just chaos. And okay, I'll open to the chaos, you know. And part of the challenge in practice is people think they have to kind of find the particular detail and bore in and find the one thing to focus on. And sometimes the right thing is to make yourself really big, the widest concentric circle. And then once you're there, then come closer. Maybe bring the concentric circles more intimately. Bring your spigot more into this experience you're having that's so wide and big. Where is it really felt? How is it really feeling here as a present moment experience in your body? What's the physical, emotional experience like? What is it here? What's the subjective experience like? The full catastrophe of the subjective experience. It's kind of like coming in closer and holding that more clearly. It's a present moment experience. But again, it's kind of wide. And you feel, so you start settling into your bodily sensations and feelings and emotions and learning how to be with that. And then you can kind of bring the concentric circle closer. And then the closer might be that it might be as simple as just being with the breathing. The breathing kind of is a nexus of so many feelings and emotions and activities and reactions we have. Perhaps it's enough just to be close and you're part of it, you're connected to it all. But just as in the middle of your breathing, breathing in, breathing out, just being. And it's a closer concentric circle. Or maybe it's a particular part of your body where the full catastrophe is most strongly felt. You know, maybe your stomach is all, it turns out your stomach is all in knots. And that's like, wow, okay, let's hold that. Let's bring the nest of attention and kind of come up from underneath. Just hold that and let that be. Be with that concentric circle, the heart of it maybe in the stomach. Whatever it might be, come closer. And then as you get closer to it, what's the most intimate part of it? And you might notice that when you're thinking about it and judging it and planning around it and trying to fix it and analyze it, you're actually not that intimate with your experience. And so what would it mean to be intimate? And this is where the body, I think, is so important in this practice. You know, the intimacy is almost a physical thing, or it can be a physical thing, right? So you feel to be intimate, physically intimate with what's happening, with your experience. And part of the reason this is so important in meditation practice and developing samadhi is samadhi is, in part, a physical embodied experience, especially in the first stages of samadhi. And so you kind of get close and get intimate with what's here and then stay with it. And then see if you can have kind of rest with the experience. Steady the mind, compose the mind and experience. So you're just here with this. And so, you know, and sometimes we start these concentric circles and then we come closer and closer and then something happens and we have to open up again and more widely. And then we start again, slowly comes in, then, you know. But slowly, the idea is to let the marble, let the of the present, you know, come into the present and be held in that nest. And where's the center? Where's the center of those concentric circles? And sometimes people say it's the mindfulness itself or awareness itself as a center. Maybe it's getting closer to the center, and so just hold that wonderful feeling of being aware and present, the aliveness, the preciousness of being aware. And then, but you know, the very center is sometimes is called a still point, a place of deep rest or deep peace or deep stillness, where you know, you can't maybe say much about it. You can't really have a relationship to it like through your thoughts and ideas, but you can become it. You can settle in, you become that still point. You become the emptiness of it, the stillness, the silence of it, the mystery of it. Kind of come in and you know, just be with experience as it is. Part of the beauty of samadhi, and one of the reasons why it can be so rewarding for some people, is that it's an alternative way of experiencing ourselves from experiencing ourselves through the filter of our ideas, our thoughts, and even our emotions. Many people, you know, their primary understanding or way of orienting themselves to the world and to themselves is in fact through beliefs, and stories, and memories, and identifications, and also through emotions that they might have. And it's a little bit kind of, you know, to have these ideas and those things and relate to through those, we're a little bit outside of our life. But samadhi allows something that is not your self-conscious mind, your self-preoccupied mind to operate and run the show, but allows for some upwelling of energy, upwelling of feelings, of emotions, upwelling of peace and well-being that kind of swells and upwells kind of from it within the body and kind of flows outwards rather than the usual kind of self-conscious, self-preoccupied, self-identified place that we sometimes operate from. I don't know how it is for you, but for me, it's more like, rather than something welling up from inside on its own, natural arising, it's more like this little kind of control tower that's kind of like, you know, has all these, in the old days, before technology, it used to have puppet strings, you know, pulling everything and trying to make everything go and do everything. And nowadays, it's just, it uses its iPad to push the buttons, the controls. So this upwelling, so some of the language the Buddha used for samadhi, this upwelling is that of a peaceful mountain lake in which there is nothing flows in from the outside. So it's not dependent on what it sees, hears, touches, you know, the relationship it has with the world. And so there's no rivers flowing in, there's no rain coming into this lake. But the lake is getting replenished with fresh, pure water from an underground underwater spring. So maybe the base of the lake, there's a spring that sends water up, and you can imagine the water coming from with some pressure from the bottom, and it gets pushed up into the lake, and it spreads out. This refreshing, pure water spreads out and moves out throughout. So sometimes this feeling of the upwelling of goodness, the upwelling of connectedness, upwelling of well-being, of joy and goodness, is part of the function, part of what happens in samadhi when the mind is soft and inclusive and relaxed and settled. The other, as it gets more deep, the Buddha referred to another image for samadhi, and that was a lake that is completely calm and still. So there's no spring underneath flowing in and making movement, this nice movement of refreshing water, but it's more peaceful and really quiet and still, pure, beautiful, clear. And in this lake, there is all these lotus blossoms of all kinds of different colors, red and blue and white. And they're kind of floating, and so apparently lotus blossoms can blossom or open under the water, above the water. And so the image is that of all these beautiful, beautiful flowers that are floating around. And the Buddha said, and no part of the flower is not touched or suffused by the refreshing water, peaceful water of the lake. So we're in this kind of, so I love this idea of all these little flowers, beautiful color flowers, because this is supposed to be an analogy for ourselves, who we are. And so there's kind of beginning a sense that there's something precious and beautiful here within us, and that it's kind of being, it's kind of swimming or floating and being touched by something very refreshing, very pure, very clear, is kind of the image of it. So I also think of samadhi as being generally very good news, because it provides us with a very different vision, understanding of ourselves than some of the ways we've understood ourselves growing up, and some of the messages and lessons and conditioning we have that kind of creates sometimes very strong kind of ideas of who we are, what the world is, that maybe it doesn't serve us so well. Maybe it served us as a child, but then as we get older, it doesn't really serve us anymore. And so to have this reconditioning of samadhi can be very helpful, to be able to hold all this, to hold the ways that we feel hurt or wounded or afraid, to hold that in samadhi, to hold that in this simple, quiet, peaceful lake, and have it touched by the peace, have all these flowers that we have, the flowers of fear, the blossoms of anger, the blossoms of regret, shame, to have them all kind of supported and held by the experience we have, is a re-education, is a reconditioning that's quite powerful. The function of samadhi in the path to liberation is certainly to do a lot of healing, and it can be healing to do it, but it's also to help steady the mind and clear the mind, the heart, well enough so that it can see clearly. If some of you maybe have driven around in a car where the windshield was completely full of dust and bird droppings and, you know, dirt and all that, and then someone decided to clean it for you, and maybe for you, you're driving a long distance and you didn't even notice how it slowly got dirty more and more, and then you stop someplace and someone saw your car and clean your windshield for you, and you come back, wow, I didn't know it was that dirty. This actually happens with me with my glasses sometimes. My wife will say, Gil, I'll clean your glasses for you. Wow. Look, she's cleaning her glasses. So part of the function of samadhi is to clear the inner lens so we can see more clearly. We don't have the agitation of a lot of thoughts and a lot of judgments and a lot of commentary about the experience, but we can see it. We don't have a lot of emotional filters that we see through, but we can see much more clearly. And also that we can see steadily. So there's a real steadiness of the mind. And the analogy I have is that of a tripod or a telescope. If you hold a telescope and try to look up into the sky at the moon, you're probably not going to be able to see it very well because you can't hold it steady enough. But if you put the tripod on the telescope on a tripod, then you can, it's steady and you can look at this moon far in the distance. So the same way with our minds, we want to be able to look very deep into the full moon in our own hearts and minds, or really deep and see what's really going on here. And the mind has to be clear and it has to be steady. So to cultivate steadiness, to be on retreat and live and behave on the retreat in such a way that supports you to be composed and steady. Not to do a lot of different things, not to jump around fast, not to be scattered in what you do, not do two things at once, but just going to be really there. If you're going to do something, just do that one thing. So you're cultivating steadiness and composure and not being scattered and divided. And so, you know, if you're at the buffet table for a meal, you wouldn't be kind of dipping into the, you know, the polenta, and while you're doing that, looking over and seeing what you're going to put on it, you know, and wondering, is going to be enough tomatoes for me at the end of the table, you know. You just, when you're just there with, just do the polenta. you know, one-pointed concentration, the polenta samadhi. Or if you're getting tea, just do the pulling the tea bag out of the container samadhi. Don't do the pulling out of the tea out and wondering, is anybody watching me to see if I chose the right tea? You know, there must be a right tea at a retreat center, right? The right tea, and it's a test. Is anybody? Just do the pulling out the tea samadhi and put it in. But if you want to make sure that people are, you know, how people are judging you, what tea you take out, just do the wondering if people are judging you samadhi. You stop pulling it out and sit there and stand there, and you're like, take that in. I don't mean it as a joke. I mean, actually, it's actually a kind of a helpful thing. If you recognize you're doing something like that, and you never really stopped and felt it, and felt it with care and compassion, stop and just feel that. Oh, the real thing happening here is not pulling a tea bag out. The real thing that I need to hold in this concentric circle, what's really important, is, you know, I'm so concerned what people think about me, and okay, let me be with that for a little bit. It's okay. This retreats are a great place to really attend and feel and hold, you know, what goes on in our minds, what goes on in our hearts. This kind of samadhi, this compassion, making yourself a nest, a peaceful place for whatever's going on in you. Make yourself a safe person, a safe place for your fear to be. Make yourself a safe place for your anger to be. Just, it's okay here. I mean, that's kind of be settled. If you're really afraid, do the fear samadhi. Just be with that. Be with that. Just feel that. Know that. All that. So one of the ways of steadying the mind on retreat is just do one thing at a time as best you can. Simplify things. Simplify just this. So as the mind becomes steadier and clearer, at some point, we'll start seeing things as they are. In fact, the Buddha said this explicitly. He said, someone who is concentrated, someone with samadhi, will see things as they are. It's almost like it follows. As the mind gets quiet and still, you don't have to do the work of trying to look and understand what's happening and do the work of trying to see how things are and trying to have insight. Insight will happen if your mind has this stillness and steadiness and clarity. And so to be able to see what's really going on here, to see behind the veil, behind the curtain, what's really here, the curtain of our thoughts, curtain of our projections, curtain of our judgments, curtain of our emotions. And generally things are different behind the curtain than what we usually think. And I think of Dorothy pulling the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. The great Wizard of Oz, this majestic voice, it's like the voice of God, right? And the authority. And when they pulled the curtain, just a little, I remember him as a little kind of plump little cute guy. So you pull your curtain, you know, and see what's really here, what's really going on. And there's layers and layers of what we discover in that process of starting to see what's here. As the mind gets stiller and stiller, quieter and quieter in there, you start seeing not just what's unique to ourselves, their own little story, our stories and how we act and our responses to the world, our beliefs. But we start kind of actually dropping below that layer, because that's just one layer of our life. It's an important layer, but it's not the only layer. We're bigger than that. We're more than that. And it's, you know, it's nice not to stop at that layer or get too preoccupied with layers. It has its things that it needs for sure. But there's much more. And to kind of drop below that layer to not that which is unique to you because of your history and of your life, but to drop down to what's called the aspects of life which are universal to everyone. Everyone shares. And so in Buddhism, one of those things is everyone shares a world where things are changing all the time. Things are transient. Things are in flux and in movement. And that involves all kinds of challenges and joys. There are benefits and there are losses to be had in this world of change and transiency. But we all share it. It has different stories connected to it, different ideas connected to it. But to kind of settle and just to kind of be aware, not of the personal aspects of transiency, but some of the deepest aspects of how things, just how things change. They're always changing. And this is universal. They've always been changing for people. You know, birth and death. A couple gives birth to a child, and it's a miracle. Wow. Can there really be 6 billion miracles on the planet at the same time? Is it still a miracle? You know, birth is pretty common. And then when it's time to die, is it a transgression to die? Is it, that, you know, what is death? People have been dying for millennia. It's part of their life. The life arises and life passes. Is this universality of these things? If we see the universality of it and we don't take it so personally, do we have a different vision of the world, different way of being in the world, different understanding? Part of what we learn to see more deeply is that the quest for happiness is often a misunderstanding. When the quest for happiness is a quest to acquire and to get and to have experiences that are going to do it for us. Some people who pursue samadhis are looking for the experience which is going to make them happy. The right experience to have. This is what it should be about. So looking for something, an experience, something in the world, some worldly gain, some relationship, something that's going to make us happy. And as the mind gets composed and settled and at home in itself, nesting in itself, being able to see clearly for what's here, steady, it's possible to become clear that the pursuit of happiness by rearranging the world, the things of the world, and getting the right experiences is like rearranging the deck chairs in the Titanic. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure you can be comfortable for a few minutes in the Titanic at the right time if you rearrange the deck chairs, but that's not going to help much. But there is a kind of deeper sense of well-being that comes from being free. It comes from not searching, not looking, not grasping. And so to really see how this works in our own hearts, to feel it, to feel how the craving and the reaching for happiness doesn't quite work, and feel, obviously, that if you release the grip, it feels so much better. And in the released grip, there is a different kind of happiness, different kind of satisfaction, than the happiness of gripping something and think you have it, whatever it might be. So to release. And then there's a deeper insight into that Yes, we can take things personally. There is a personal side to life, for sure. But it's only one layer, it's only one approach, one view, one perspective to have. And it's not a perspective that tends to be very stable. It's not a perspective that sometimes is accurate. And it's not a perspective that provides the greatest sense of being at home in this world. And oddly enough, to be really settled in this world, at home in your own heart, it actually helps to put to rest a lot of the self-preoccupation we have and seeing things through the filter of me, myself, and mine. And so at some point, when the mind is steady and clear and still, it becomes obvious, oh, this movement towards self and selfing and me and defining myself, it doesn't really serve me. There is another place to be. There's a deeper place to rest where we don't take things personally. Anger arises, and it's just anger. I don't have to get involved or name it or make it my own. Joy arises. It's joy. I don't have to make it my own or define myself by it. It's just phenomena rolling through, happening. I came to a place in my own practice where if this became clear to me that I wasn't being served by my how I was trying to portray myself to the world and to myself. And I could see the stress and the pain of this self-ideation, self-concept I was caught with. And I knew that the next step, next task, was to let it go. And I was also very clear that I was too afraid to let go of it. So I didn't. And so I kind of, you know, lived with it for a while and knew it was there, knew what I had to do, but I wasn't ready to do it. And then I said, I think I need a ritual to help me. And so the ritual that I did was I was flying to Asia to practice in Asia. And I said to myself, crossing the international date line in the middle of the Pacific, that was going to be my ritual. I was going to let go. So I can't say that I let go just by crossing, you know, the Pacific. But that trip to practice in Asia was when I finally was able to put down this burden of self that I carried for so long. And I think that ritual kind of predisposed me, my mind, my heart, to be start the work, inner work, that was not even my own work. It wasn't like I had to do it, but this inner work of releasing this place. So it's the function of this samadhi is to create the stability, the nesting, the coziness, the sense of safety, the sense of joy and well-being, and the steadiness of mind. So we're able to kind of steadily look reality in the eye, really see what's here in an honest, direct way. It's kind of a courageous thing to cultivate samadhi. It's a courageous thing to cultivate this seeing things as they are. To look reality right in the eye and really see what's going on in some deep way. And have the reference point of samadhi to help us see clearly and also to help us see that there is an alternative to expecting things to be permanent or wanting things to be permanent. There is an alternative to being troubled by impermanence. There is a place of freedom in the world of impermanence. There is an alternative to the constant search for happiness. And happiness in the things which are kind of not going to provide happiness, really deep happiness. And the samadhi kind of gives you the intuition, the sense, yes, there is some place else, some place that kind of wells up from inside, doesn't depend, it's independent of the conditions of the world. And the deep place of samadhi, settledness, being nesting in the peace of this moment, and then seeing, you know, the movement of taking things personally, and the I-ing and me-ing and my-ing, and all the concern around that, and seeing how that works, and seeing that there is value, at least for a period of time, putting some of that to rest and not seeing the world through self ideas. And just let everything kind of unfold and move without needing to have any reference to self. Reality can be free of me, finally. One way of understanding liberation in Buddhism is that you don't get liberated. You'll never get liberated. If you're looking to get liberated, never happen. What we're really going to happen is that the world finally gets liberated from you. Wouldn't that be nice? So, but you know, you benefit too. So the samadhi shows you that you benefit from all this letting go. You'll benefit from this settling back and the simpler world. So composure, peace in the middle of the waterfall, nesting, coming in, concentric circles coming in and being intimate and close to the place of rest, at the place at the bottom of the bowl, right here. Where's the heart of this experience? Where's the nest that holds it all? To settle into oneself and allow the energies of life to move through you freely. Get out of the way. Settle and open up. To let the mind become quiet and still, not by force, because it feels good to let it rest. The mind becomes still and quiet, focused, composed, steady. To have a steadiness of body, steadiness of mind, sweet steadiness of heart. And having that as a vantage point to see, to understand how things are. And this is the wisdom of the Buddha, wisdom of practice. Start seeing things more deeply as they are. And with the support of being settled, as we see things as they are, the water starts becoming a bigger river flowing down the mountainside. And there's a momentum that begins happening. There's a flow, a natural flow of deepening and opening that feels more and more like we're being practiced rather than we're doing the practice. And so that will be then the topic for tomorrow. And Adrian takes us on the journey to the next two steps of liberative dependent arising. So let's get recomposed. Compose yourself back into your practice mode and